CliffCentral.com.
Oh, Aces, and Don't Look Back in Anger. Everybody always talks about Wonderwall, but that's their best song by far. What a song. What a happy thing to wake up to on a Tuesday morning. If you've just joined us now, good morning, CliffCentral.com. Somebody said we sound like an AM broadcast this morning. Because one of the important bits of the equipment just suddenly decided to give us hell. But we will see if we can rectify that during the course of this show this morning. Pumi Mashiko is here, Sia Sangweni is here, and Bulelo Tinta is also hanging around in the background trying to sort things out. Got lots to get to this morning.
Just before we go further, I tried to nod along with this, and then I realized, I clarified before being a dodo for the rest of my life. JJ said, what about a he wore his sunglasses in his eyes?
On the inside.
What does that even mean?
He wasn't really seeing everything clearly, Sia.
Oh, wait, is that a common phrase?
No, it was probably something that was developed especially for Muammar Gaddafi because he wasn't entirely connected to reality all the time. So he was looking at the world.
Okay, because I was like nodding on and going, No, what does this mean? Okay.
I was hoping JJ would tell us about Brother Leader's bodyguards, infamous lady bodyguards as well.
You know that he only ever had women guarding him.
Was that for a particular reason?
Yeah, probably he preferred looking at women while he was being guarded. Yeah, exactly. But apparently they worked
quite good. Then.
It wasn't purely for aesthetics. Apparently they knew how to do the job too.
So, they're highly trained killers.
That's right. So something that Sia raised here, and I didn't know this either, so I feel like it's a bit of a lesson for all of us, and I'd be surprised if you know what the hell this is all about. But Sia, Sade, the singer, you know. Smooth Operator. That's a great song there. Apparently, that isn't even her name.
Right.
Not even her stage name.
So
this is very new information for me. So apparently Sade is not the name of the woman who sings. It's the name of the band.
Yes. Now I feel better because I'm not alone in this. I don't even know how I came about it yesterday. But I discovered that Sade is the name of the whole band. And then the woman who I assumed, and I would assume that a lot of other people think is Sade, her name is actually Helen. I didn't even know it was a whole band.
But there is even more to the story because that's not all there is. Apparently her surname is where they get the name of the band from.
No, her second name.
It's her second name. And I might butcher how it's pronounced, but Fola Sade or Fola Sade.
Okay.
And then they got those four last letters of her second name. So it's spelled Folasade. So they took the Sade from her second name. And they're like, oh, yeah, let's make a band out of this. But if it's a band, do you guys even know the rest of the band members? Because I don't.
No, never heard of any of them. I'm pretty sure they would. I wouldn't know them if they were shopping next to me today. So this is the kind of information that we like finding on the show because I know there's always going to be a reason why you're at a general knowledge quiz one day and someone asks a question about Sade and you will be the only one who knows the answer.
Some things you just blow your mind.
According to Monwabisi, I make the same mistake with The Weeknd because it's the person is The Weeknd, not the band. The Weeknd is one guy. It's one guy.
Oh, no. Okay. No, I knew that.
Yes.
Okay. I knew that.
No, Sade, this is so the Sade story, you know, which is Yoruba. So her name is Yoruba. She's British Nigerian. She's of Nigerian descent. Mm-hmm. But like for discerning music lovers, this has been the thing for a long, long time. And
oh, we just probably, are not in the know?
You probably just got onto it because you know that she hasn't released new music. The band hasn't released new music in years. I think the first thing that they released after about 15 years was that song that they did for the movie.
A movie, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for A Wrinkle in Time, Flower of the Universe. But they're releasing a six records set this year, I think. I don't know if it's out yet. Yeah. New music.
Okay. So it's
quite an exciting experience.
I know maybe two songs from Sade, and that's it.
Yeah, there's that King of Something one, and then
King of Sorrow.
Yeah, King of Sorrow, and then Smooth Operator. Yeah,
that's the only two I know.
So Sade, wow, the band actually consists of four members. Helen, I will now call her by her government name, Helen. Okay. A Paul Denman, an Andrew Hale, and a Stuart Matthewman. It, knowing all of this now takes away the coolness that I had.
What?
You know, this, I don't know, I just felt like Sade was making music on some sandy beach, drinking from a coconut. And she just had dreadlocks all the time, but then when she performed, she let her hair down. Ah, now Helen. Ah, Helen.
So Ruth says this morning, apparently she also used to make the same mistake. Oh, no, sorry, it's Justice. Justice Leshilo says he made the same mistake with Lucy Pearl. You know, don't mess with my man. Don't mess with my boy.
Yes.
Raphael said this thing.
Apparently, that's a group, not a person, Lucy Pearl.
Yeah.
Oh, guys. This is ruining everything.
This is why CDs were so important. This is why CDs were so important. Because you got the sleeve, you took it out, you read stuff on the sleeve of the CD, who wrote what, the 20 people involved in writing the song, the guitarist.
Knowing that stuff was the only reason some DJs had a job.
Yo!
Right.
You people. That's why CDs were important. That's the thing I do say, I must say. That's one of the things that I absolutely hate about iTunes. Is you get stuck in this feedback loop of the stuff you know and like. And that's all you ever play. And it's, you know, and they've just recently done an upgrade that it'll send you stuff. It'll send you recommendations and it'll send you like a radio, like it'll send the weekend radio and play all sorts of music that sounds in the similar tempo or with similar artists or that's featured. But it's just like, you never know these things. I love the fact that they've got the lyrics thing now because, again, CD sleeves, man. CD sleeves. You used to pull that thing out. It had all the lyrics to the song. You could sing along. No Mondegreens in your life. Come on, guys.
It must be so cool and quite rock star-ish, though, to be in that elite group of people who don't have to release music or don't have to create anymore because you've made like a staple, you know, like the Sade band. They just, you know, they have those select few songs and somehow every generation gets to know it and, you know, they still make their money. They might go on tour here and there if they want to, but nah, you know, they've proven themselves.
Well,
Bill Withers was one of my favorite kind of R&B soul singers. He had a whole lot of songs, a whole lot of albums, but of course we also, with Bill Withers, we only know three or four that are like Grandma's Hands, Lovely Day, that kind of stuff. And in one of his interviews, he says, you know, that's those four songs took his kids through school and fed him till he died. And his wife's primary job was just following up on the royalties for those songs.
Lord, hear my cry. Lord, please.
Well, I'll never forget the premise for, I think it was that Notting Hill movie. The premise for that movie was that Hugh Grant had written one Christmas jingle and it had provided with enough income to kind of live a life of luxury. And there are people in the music world who have done that. I mean, especially composers, people you've probably never heard of, who have great lives. They never have expense problems because the royalties have covered them for many years and will for many more. And that's their whole life. It's fantastic. I'd like to write one great song and also do that.
Right?
No.
I told you guys about Tina Turner and how when she decided she's retiring, she went on one tour, one tour for her retirement, and that was planned her retirement around one tour.
Speaking of having tons of money, the Euro Millions is one of Europe's favorite draws. It's currently standing at 1.2 billion rand. The draw takes place tonight at 8:45 South African time. And then there is the big giant, the U.S. Mega Millions, which is now standing at 7.1 billion rand. That's B, Bill, for Bill Gates, because that's the that's where you'll be if you win 7.1 billion rand. That's amazing.
That's how you know we're playing with Monopoly money here in this country, guys.
Absolutely. The Mega Millions draw takes place on Wednesday at 5 a.m. SA time. Don't miss out on these big payouts, only on Lotto Land. Go and bet now. You can go and get involved at lottoland.co.za. Lotto Land is licensed with the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board. You have to be 18 years or older to place a bet. Winners know when to stop. The National Responsible Gambling Toll-Free Counseling Line is 0800-006-008. 7.1 billion rand.
Ooh-wee. Now that's a pretty penny. That's a pretty penny. Hey, talking about money, here's a developing story right now. There is a mysterious hacking group that are pulling a Robin-esque type of pattern. They are hacking into... Robin Hood-esque type of pattern. They are hacking into these multi-million dollar companies, getting access into their bank accounts, taking money from there, and then donating it to charity. So far, they've done it to two charities. And both those charities are actually saying, look, this is not cool. We get that, you know, it might seem cool from these hackers, but you can't be doing something like this. So, in a post on the dark web, this gang first posted receipts of $10,000 in Bitcoin donations to two separate charities. One of them, Children International, says that will not be keeping the money. They said that the move is being seen as a strange and troubling development, both morally and legally. But the hackers claim that they only target large profitable companies with their ransomware attacks. And the attacks hold organizations' IT systems hostage until a ransom is paid. How crazy is this?
So,
like what happened to Telkom?
Basically, someone hacked into some company's balance sheet and stole money for charities. Okay. Well, it just shows you that there are some hackers who at least have a good heart, even if they're bad people. They're doing criminal things, but they mean well. Of course,
I think most of them think that that's what they're doing. I think most of them think that they mean well. The motivations are always good. We're just going to like dox all these people on the internet because they're bad people. We think they're bad people and people should go and make loud noises outside their houses. Oh, these are state secrets. They shouldn't be. We're just going to put them out there in large tables on the internet.
Do you know what I think their flaw is? The fact that these hackers publicize this. And I think that's how the charities also feel pressure to say, no, this is not cool. We're going to give the money back. If really you just woke up with an SMS or an email rather that states, hey, don't ask where this money came from. We thought you were worthy enough for it. Here you go. And don't tell anyone. I would also keep quiet. Would you?
You know what happens in those situations? They will always find you. No one, remember the person who's lost a couple of million rand or whatever is not just going to let that go. They're going to want to find out where it went. And the thing about electronic paper trails is that they're fairly easy to follow. you just basically the breadcrumbs of the pebbles and you find the witch.
Dude,
that'll be new.
Again, it's a lesson you learn from watching the days of Judge Zondo. Mm-hmm. People might say they didn't know, but those bank accounts. Didn't I send you the video of the lady who when they said, we've got, so you'll be able to, first she was kind of like, oh, Gana, what's her name? From SAA. I want to say she was from SAA. And they're like, oh, she was so arrogant. She was like, oh, nah. And then they're like, so can you show us that you spent them, you paid for your mom's tires or car or whatever? And she was like, what? Find bank statements from 2016. And with the lawyer that was leading the evidence said, yeah, we've got the bank statements. We've got them. So you can show. She almost had a heart attack. She didn't know what to say. She was like, what? the look on her face as she then realized that these people have got access to the bank accounts. And so they're like, yeah, we've seen the bank accounts. We know when the money landed in your accounts. And we know how it was spent and who it was saved and when. So you can just... It was awesome. Those are the moments you watch this thing for.
She didn't know that they could get hold of her bank statements?
I don't know. I mean, the level of arrogance that you see out there, guys.
What world did she live in?
In a few short weeks, we'll be looking at Floyd Shivambo's VPS bank statements. Because those have been subpoenaed last week.
Ah, interesting. Then we'll see what happens there.
Guys, come watch. Come and watch. It's like watching a telenovela every single day. It's just like
I'm relying on your updates. The gamble of just hours and hours and hours and then nothing happens. No, thank you. But I bet you.
Darren wants to argue with you. He says hackers with good intentions. I think that's the majority of hackers. So agreeing with you in that part. But there's actually ethics hackers, that hackers should follow when they have been trained and educated formally. And you know, lots of businesses hire ethical hackers to help them foolproof their systems, right? So that they know that they are less at risk of being hacked into, being disrupted. Having criminals come and take advantage of them. So this is already happening.
So that is not what I am disputing at all. No. I think most people think that their intentions are good. Most people think that their intentions are good. Most people that hurt people do so with an intention not to hurt because they think that they are doing good.
Yeah. I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks that they're going to have a day of pure evil. Today, I'm going to just commit evil acts. I mean, even the evil people.
Oh, there are people like that. There are people like that. Don't you watch Netflix?
Yeah, but those are the fiction characters. Most of the people who we call evil today think that they were doing wonderful things. They think they were doing things for the good of humanity. They could justify it. They could give you a rationale, all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it so one-dimensional because when you see a villain in a movie or in a book or whatever it might be, we always think, well, doesn't that villain realize that they're bad? But that's so simplified because even the worst people in history have thought at some point that what they were doing was for the good of humanity. They were doing something honorable. They were being decent. They didn't think they were being bad people.
I guess
you do the Blind History podcast, and you know from your research that every time you come across somebody that you think, when you look back today with 2020 hindsight vision, is you're kind of going, what a wild ride. But in the moment, at the time, it's what we see. I'm sure if you had this conversation even with Jean-Jacques, he'll tell you what we see all the time. Time and again, is we see people marching into the town square, pulling off a coup because they think their government is awful and corrupt. And 10 years down the line, they have not given back the power. When you look back at the history of Robert Mugabe and where he started out and what he was intending, what his intentions were, and where he ends up. And he's just kind of going, I'm not ready. I haven't fulfilled the promise that I said I would. but at what cost?
But
so
not
the
to
intentions of people.
But not to completely not give these people responsibility. There comes the time where there's a shift, though, where you realize exactly what you're doing, and they don't take responsibility of their actions. They're like, okay, let's carry on then.
Yeah, like we were talking earlier with Jean-Jacques Cornish about Bashir al-Assad. Is that his name? No, that's the guy in Syria. Muammar al-Bashir.
Sudanese.
Yeah, the Sudanese,
Al-Bashir.
So he's just been locked up in jail in Sudan. But you remember when he was lording it over everybody here at the African Union summit, walking around. He knew he was pretty much untouchable at that stage. But you see how quickly things can turn.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope our politicians are paying attention, because the ones who have stolen money and who have been involved in fraudulent and corrupt activity, I hope they know that there is going to be a price paid and the piper comes.
But it is not the politicians who should be paying attention. It is us. Because, and this is the point, is their intentions were, and so see, I disagree with you, is there is, at no point is a person going, oh, maybe I should stop. Now, you know, I've gone too far. Because for them, they can always justify it to themselves. It is us who should be paying attention. We are the ones that should call the time out. And then we are the ones that should say, this fine, no further. For as long as we enable it by being quiet on the sidelines, by not participating in government, by not holding them accountable and hoping that their better nature is going to take care of it. That's just plain foolish.
On that note, I know Sia's got an update for us on Angelo Agrizi. Remember the guy who kind of opened that Bosasa can of worms, and we're still getting revelations from his testimony. So what's happened to Angelo Agrizi?
It seems like he has the shakes. His condition has supposedly worsened. So I saw that. As of yesterday afternoon, his condition has allegedly worsened, and he has been moved to a private hospital. This is what his lawyer confirmed yesterday afternoon. They said that his lawyer, Daniel Witz, says that he was dealing with a situation. This is the official word from the lawyer. A situation, and could not provide further details. Later, when the lawyer was asked via text message whether it was true that the former Bosasa executive has been moved from a state facility to a private hospital, the lawyer simply replied yes. He then provided further details, saying, we were contacted by a representative from Correctional Services who informed us that Mr. Agrizi's condition had worsened. So, must be nice. They say that the family approved this transfer to high care, and he is being moved as they were speaking yesterday afternoon, and they were busy stabilizing him. So, okay.
Where's that clown makeup?
We're all being taken for fools here.
Yeah. You know, there's still people who think that Gavin
My
Watson...
red nose.
They didn't think Gavin Watson died. They think that was all a cover-up.
Yeah. Gareth. Oh, yes. Okay, yeah. I believe this.
You believe this. You're one of the conspiracy theorists. Go ahead.
So all it took was, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we don't know who this user is, and she hasn't provided more context from what I've seen. But she's a person who logged onto Twitter. Really, yeah, we could be all fools for believing her. But she logged onto Twitter and she said, guys, I'm on a Zoom meeting. And Gavin Watson just popped up and then went off again. That's all it took.
Wow. So you think that's
no,
true?
But what she posted was she posted, you know, the Zoom screen where people's cameras are off and then it has your initials on it, you know,
yeah.
So yours would have a G and C, right? And it had a GW. She posted this thing, and it had a GW. And at the bottom, it said Gavin Watson. Right?
And then I need to try and remember. I could find it, but it will take a while. Someone, it's not Nomvula.
It is Nomvula.
Was it Nomvula? It seems like she slipped when she said, when she referred to Gavin Watson as in present tense and alive, she said, Gavin Watson is, or Gavin, you know, so alluded to
it
being alive.
It was at the judge's own, it was at the commission. So when she was at the commission a couple of weeks ago, and they said, yeah, I'm telling you guys, you're missing out here not watching the commission.
All right.
So Gavin Watson, this is when Judge Zondo's mind was blown, as she says, she didn't know that Butsasa paid for her birthday party. And Judge Zondo's like, you mean somebody has committed this generous act of paying these hundreds of thousands of rands to host a party for you?
Yeah.
And you don't even want to know who it is so you can thank them? You're that kind of person? She was just like, yeah, Gavin was such a fun guy. He was wonderful. So Gavin was your friend, says Judge Zondo. So Gavin was, says, yeah, he is my friend.
And the people are inferring from that he's still alive. Oh, well, okay.
Gavin's going to be like our Elvis. He'll be spotted everywhere. Just watch this December. He'll be at Camps Bay, beach number 3.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised because, I mean, he really did feather his nest with government. So if anyone could get away with hiding their own death, it would be him, right?
I believe it. I think it was a sloppy way to hide a death. I'm actually, from here on out, I'm referring to him as someone who's good and alive. I think it was a sloppy way to fake a death. And I think he's still in the country, which is stupid. I think he should be, you know, in
how would you
Sweden right now.
How would you fake your death?
Go on. Because a car accident is quite a clever way to do it. I mean, you know, as long as you make sure emergency services...
With a burnt body, come on.
Sure. Oh, that, yes, that's good. That's good. You see, I could fake someone else's death better than I could my own.
Explain.
Well, I've watched all of these murder things way too much. The recent one that has a lot of people talking is on Netflix, and it's about Christopher Watts, who's now been termed a family annihilator, and that's when someone kills their whole entire family. And he strangled his wife in bed and then also ended up killing his two daughters. And I think he took his daughters, sorry for the gruesome details, but he took his daughters and dumped them in an oil tank and then just dug up a shallow ditch and put his wife's corpse there. Rookie error. See, if it was me, wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't have done that because they were all...
You're
what
not
would
helping
you have
us.
Done,
I still want to know
what
how you would
you have done.
How would you have faked your own death if you were, let's say you're a Greetsy right now, and you want to get the hell out of this, and you know enough people, like Gavin Watson knew enough people, so you can pull on any strings you need. How do you fake your death?
I think you plan a holiday, and like one of those random safari somethings. So you have to firstly leave the country, like fly to Namibia, fly to Mozambique, no, somewhere further, like far, 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 you know, somewhere in Africa. Tanzania. You fly to Tanzania on a commercial flight, and then you would have booked a private plane to go to some resort. And then that plane, where you have paid off 5 people to be your so-called family to get onto that plane falls from the sky. There's a horrible, horrible accident. And there are just 5 corpses that are discovered. Meanwhile, you're living your best life on the Nile. See?
But you've gone and killed 5 people.
I mean, and sorry, there's some people that will just have to be part of the process. With money, these things are possible. You blackmail 5 people, they have to die in the process.
Well, you could just be...
If I'm on the run, that means I'm not a good person. So I could easily kill people without feeling bad.
You could have slipped into the river and a crocodile could have eaten you, you know. Meanwhile, you were just rescued.
Or a lion.
A lion. You could be in a boating accident. Boating accidents are usually a good one because it's very hard to find the body if it's at sea, for example.
Oh. You know,
that's the way to do it. I think yours is sloppy. I think this... You've also got to waste a whole private jet. I mean, who's going to do that? That's expensive.
Need some thoughts.
Honey, No. Pumi, have you got a better idea?
I think the falling overboard.
Yeah.
Mm.
The falling overboard is clean, easy. I actually listened to a podcast about a guy who was rescued after he had fallen overboard in the middle of the night. And he's a trawler. So he and a friend of his have crab traps out in the ocean. And so they go out at night. And in the morning, they go and clear all the traps and reset them and come back, spend the day out at sea. Yeah. And he woke up at about 4 in the morning, and his friend was still asleep, kind of getting ready for the day. And he fell overboard, and the little yacht was on autopilot. So it kept going, and nobody heard him fall.
So
and when the friend woke up 2 hours later, he wasn't on board, and you know, big wide ocean.
You
would find someone easily there. That's the end
so
of
they,
it.
And they spent, well, he was found, and from what an incredible story, was an article. Yeah, he was found alive.
How did he stay alive?
He wasn't too far from a buoy, so he kind of swam through to the buoy and held onto it. But he almost froze to death. He really did almost freeze to death. It's an incredible story, because the chances of them finding him even alive after searching for like 8 hours, they are about to abandon the search actually for the day when they found him.
And the things in the ocean.
So when they started, and the shark circling, it was insane. His story is absolutely insane. It was an article in the New York Times a couple of years ago.
Dogoza says, Jesus, Sia, your collateral damage is quite harsh for your brain crash. And he goes on to say, Gavin's fake death is perfect, actually. There was proof that he was dead. I would have just left the country after fake dying if I was Gavin. And Ruth adding, she thinks technology has become so sophisticated that if they find any evidence at all, it's very tricky when forensics and tracking are involved. And especially with mobile devices, you know, these things keep such a record of exactly where you are. They can geolocate you in almost any part of the world. So there's quite a lot there. Trevor says private plane crashes, parachute out to a yacht at sea, no bodies, no harm. Boats are the best way to go.
But look, Ruth might think technology is really advanced. Actually, they were going to appear just messaged now. I was going to say, we still don't know what happened to a certain Malaysian airline 6 years later.
370, yeah, we still don't know.
Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, there are loopholes in everything.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, with all of these grisly plans to hide yourself from the rest of the world. Like Gavin
Watson. Gavin Watson is alive.
Yeah, that's Sia's hashtag. This morning, something really, really extraordinary. The story of Pol Pot. Now, this guy, it sounds like the kind of dish that you would order at a Cambodian restaurant, but it's actually the name of one of the most horrific people to ever walk the earth. For some reason, this guy never makes it to the first division of the truly maniacal, genocidal monsters of history. He's always in the second division, you know? Despite his murderous efforts to make his mark, in his effort to actually socially engineer Cambodia, he killed more than a third of the people who lived there. And millions of bodies in mass graves are his grisly, terrible monument. This morning, you get to hear all about Pol Pot in Blind History, the man who led Cambodia and didn't even die that long ago. So he's in living memory for some of us. Although for many people, he's just an unknown entity. You'll find out all about him now in Blind History. This is cliffcentral.com. We will see you again tomorrow morning, bright and early at 6 o'clock. For more, don't go anywhere. A gentle breeze rustles the leaves of tall palm trees which tower over a subtropical plain. Mostly flat, it has an obviously landscaped mound shaped like three sides of a rough rectangle. It seems like an unnatural physical feature in such an otherwise perfect setting. That mound is a mass grave. Called Chung Ek, it is the final resting place of over 8,000 people who were beaten to death with whatever was at hand by the henchmen of Pol Pot. He ruled Cambodia for only 4 years, and despite his horrific genocidal campaign, most people don't even know what happened. We dedicate this episode of Blind History to the more than 2 million people who were the victims of Pol Pot's failed Cambodian social engineering experiment. So this is how our favorite historian, Simon Sebag Montefiore, describes Pol Pot. He says, the communist Khmer Rouge leader who created the democidal hell known as Democratic Kampuchea ruled Cambodia for only 4 years, but in that short time, he murdered millions of innocent people. Half the population, some people say a third, he impoverished the country, he killed all the intellectuals, and started time again at the diabolical year zero. That's a hell of an introduction for anybody. And we've dealt with some pretty nasty specimens in Blind History. This guy seems to be among the most evil human beings who's ever lived. Is that saying too much? Anthony Medera is my co-host. It's Blind History. It's a brand new episode. Pol Pot is the focus of this episode. And is it too much to say that he was a maniac, a genocidal maniac?
He was a monster. He was so much more than a genocidal maniac. It was, there's so many words to describe him. It was frightening, absolutely frightening. There's no doubt he was a monster, but how big was it? Did he kill 1 million or did he kill 3 million? When you research Pol Pot, those are always the challenges because the society was completely closed. Very similar to the Kims. They actually locked down the country. The outside world didn't really know what was going on there.
So a few things about him that I hadn't any idea about until we started working on this episode. The first thing is that he only died in 1998. That's like yesterday.
Which I feel is crazy. They should have killed him in 79. The fact that he'd lived another, I don't know how long it was. It's absurd. And none of them were killed. None of them were murdered or hanged.
No, none of them even saw justice. I mean, he was supposedly sentenced, but we'll get to that. That's near the end of his story. Let's start at the beginning. Where did this guy grow up, and what kind of a childhood did he have? Because usually psychologists will tell you they can find the markings of a psychopath early in their lives. Was there any sign that he would grow up to be this evil monster?
Not really. His parents were quite well-to-do. They had rice paddies, property, and farming, and about 10 times the normal size of an average farmer in Cambodia. So he grew up just north of the capital of Phnom Penh, about 100 miles north. And his family had some royal background, or at least some connection to the royal family, at courtiers. And his older sister was a concubine of the royal family. So there was definitely links with the royal family at that time. So it seems he had quite a stable upbringing. He went with his brother to Phnom Penh when he was quite young and attended schools. It doesn't seem like he was very clever. He was a very mediocre student.
And that name, Pol Pot, it sounds like such a stupid name. But that wasn't his actual name, was it? I mean, if you were his mom, you wouldn't have called him young Pol Pot.
No. His name was Saloth Saw.
That sounds a lot more evil. Saloth Saw. It sounds like a Star Wars villain.
Yeah.
I did see, interestingly enough, for someone who ended up hating intellectuals, he studied like electronics and some fairly modern and, rather more complicated than studying, I don't know, growing plants or animal husbandry. The guy actually had the capacity to certainly learn quite a lot of things. And I wondered why he hated intellectuals so much, but that becomes clear later in the story. But he did fail a couple of times. He wasn't the brightest.
You know, what was very interesting was that the French have played a massive role in sort of the history of Cambodia. In the 1700s and 1800s, the French went into that area. I think it was called Indochina at the time. So that was part of their territory or their empire, as they called it. And so a lot of the rich kids would go and study in Paris, and he was one of them. And I think he had a government subsidy to send him to Paris.
Wow. He didn't do well. He came back and he became a teacher, I think.
Correct, yeah. So he became a private teacher, but he was spending more time developing this revolutionary ideals that he had in his head and what he wanted to do.
I thought when I was at school that we had some pretty horrible teachers, but You wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of this teacher.
No, but Mao Tse-tung played a big part in his life. That was his hero. And, you know, the agrarian, the whole point of the agricultural type society and ideology came, you know, obviously from Mao Tse-tung. And then, like everybody, you know, we've covered a lot of these guys, the communists and, you know, Marxism and Leninism. They've all played a massive role in their lives.
Up one history book, any history book, and you read one story about communism, you would realize what a terrible system it is. And just everywhere it's been implemented, it's brought nothing but death, devastation, impoverished lives, social engineering. When we talk about this agrarian revolution that he tried to impose, he actually wanted to take the clock back. He thought that people who lived on farms in these idyllic rural situations were much happier than the people in cities, that they had less, that they worked the soil, that this was a much more noble way to live. And he tried to turn the clock back. He tried to make 1975 year zero so that they could start again. And he actually removed technology. He removed thinking. He destroyed education and learning. And he sent people out of the cities to the degree that Phnom Penh, the capital you've already mentioned, was basically deserted from when he had started implementing his plan until when he was deposed.
But there were 2.5 million people actually just prior to him taking over in Phnom Penh. So it was a significant city. And, I mean, he closed the banks. There was no currency. Closed the borders, killed all the foreigners, killed all the Buddhists, killed the priests, killed the Muslim leaders. It was actually so sudden. If people were at work and they had their cars or however they got to work, they were ripped out of their offices, ripped out of their surgeries, hospitals, and put on the street straight away. And they had to now walk to the fields. And that's what it was like. And you know that when you're a doctor, you're not used to tending rice paddies. And a lot of the population didn't even make it to the agricultural fields, et cetera, where they were force marched. So many died on the fields, you know, where they were working, where they had to work. And they worked 12 hours a day. The rations weren't enough. So they would die. And especially the people that come out of the cities, they just weren't geared for it. So they died very quickly. And that's where they died. They just closed the graves. And that's where the mass killing fields have come from. This is just open rice paddies where they're just dumping bodies. Must have been absolutely frightening for the population. And it doesn't make any logical sense how they could figure out that this was going to work. It's classless. And everybody's a farmer. And that just feeds the army who's now protecting the border because Vietnam keeps trying to come in again.
So you mentioned Mao already. Mao was his only real friend, and otherwise he cut himself off completely from the outside world. So there were very few people who were allowed in and very few people from inside who were allowed to know anything about what happened outside. In that way, it does mirror North Korea. But there were a few journalists. I read a story about a woman who was invited to report for an American publication from Cambodia, and she went in. And she was given an interview with him where he mostly ranted and raved about the Vietnamese and how he was going to kill them. And she went to a guest house where she and two other journalists were staying. And that night, the army came to the guest house and tried to kill all three of them. Now, they were there to interview this guy. So I don't know how he thought that would turn out. But she reported that she'd seen mostly healthy people and that she'd seen a mother nursing her baby. And it didn't look so bad. And she was actually asked to testify in a trial much later on where people accused her of defending the regime and making up propaganda that was favorable to them. And, of course, she didn't know that they were acting the whole thing out. They were only letting her see what they wanted her to see. What was going on under the surface was much, much more dangerous. So tell me about the Khmer Rouge. This is the organization that Pol Pot led.
The Khmer Rouge was really frightening. I mean, they carried out the most frightening killings and genocide that in the modern era has not been seen before. And there was a movie made about it, I think, in the 80s. This is before Pol Pot died. He was still running his show in the jungles of Cambodia, just on the Thai border, when the killing fields came out. What was interesting was that this political communist party really hated actually the North Vietnamese communists and anybody else that was out of Cambodia. But, you know, the United States has also played a big role in this because, as we know, the Vietnam War was carrying on going because the United States didn't want any communism to grow. Because they were close to South Vietnam, they got involved to protect them. But actually what happened, the Cambodian government under the king, Sihanouk, said that he was neutral, but he actually kept Viet Congs and North Vietnam armies within Cambodia. So the U.S. found that out. They dropped more bombs in Cambodia than they did in the Second World War in Japan.
Wow.
They said three times as much. And that actually helped Pol Pot and his gang to grow, because now there was such strong anti-U.S. sentiment and also outside sentiment. So that drove the xenophobic side of it. So even if somebody had communist ideologies, if he was in Vietnamese, that'd kill him. You know, it's, or if he was a Chinese or Thai, that'd kill him. So it's communism tainted with xenophobic ideology. So this is what made this communist regime so much different to many others that we've looked at or that was around in those times.
And like a purity test. So you could fail on communism, that would be a reason to kill you, as you say. You could fail on ethnicity, and that would be a reason to kill you. You could be too clever, or you could be too stupid, or you could be too tall or too short. They would find any reason. If they wanted to kill you, they'd just kill you.
Exactly. And what was very sad, if you wore glasses, you were dead. So
that's a story that I remember hearing, and I thought it was an urban legend, but it turns out that this guy was so pathological that he thought that people who wore glasses were intellectuals. And funnily enough, that is something which people continue to think today. And you see some of our politicians who put on glasses and they suddenly think they're smarter than they were without the glasses. But this guy, he was afraid of people who wore glasses because he thought they were too clever. They were intellectuals, and therefore they could represent some kind of threat to his regime. So if you just wore glasses because you had bad eyes, off you were marched to the killing fields.
Yeah, and he said in a statement that, look, obviously you've got glasses because you've been reading too many books. Anybody that was urbanized, he would take out. And the farmers that had been farming before were a little bit better treated. But if you were urbanized, the chances of you surviving was almost zero.
I believe the Khmer Rouge also had a particular way of killing people. They were forced to dig their own graves before the Khmer Rouge soldiers would beat them, their tired bodies. They'd beat them with iron bars, axes, and hammers until they died, because they'd been instructed not to waste bullets.
It was frightening what they did.
So how many people were killed? You said earlier it's very difficult to estimate because there was no international reporting allowed from inside of Cambodia, and they did manage to seal it off mostly from the world. I mean, if it's between 1 and 3 million, that means that there could be 2 million people who there's not even a record in history for them. It isn't like, you know, we talk about Alexander the Great. There's a little footnote that says there may have been 5,000 Persians killed in this battle or whatever. But 2 million people that could have just gone missing to history in the 20th century, no less.
They're saying it's about a third of the population. And that excludes the civil war that happened prior to that, because he now wanted to take over and become prime minister. And there, the 500,000 people were killed in that civil war. And that both parties committed massive atrocities in that civil war. There was no kindness or anything in terms of prisoners of war. There were no rules. So 500,000 were killed even before that this genocide started.
It kind of shows you also how the world's media are quite, I don't want to say ethnocentric or racist, because I think people use that word too much. But, you know, there's the standard that if, you know, 4,000 people die in New York in the 9/11 attacks, we make a massive deal of it. And rightly so. New York is like the capital of the world. It's the world's most cosmopolitan city. But here we have millions and millions of people who died mostly in my lifetime and yours. Most of these people died during the time I have been alive.
Me too, yeah.
And yet there's no fuss made about them. People talk about Hitler. People talk about Stalin. They even talk about Mao. Pol Pot seems to be a second-rate dictator killer, autocrat murderer, despot, tyrant. You know, he's like in the second rung, but this guy was a maniac.
He was absolutely a maniac. I mean, it really does make some of these, the Stalins and the Hitlers of the world, almost look like bunnies.
Did he have any personal life at all? I mean, were there any people close to him?
Yeah, so he had two marriages. His first marriage was to a lady that was linked to the royal family. So in the beginning, I mean, he definitely was from the wealthier side of the world, and he had a child. I must be honest, I've tried to find out what happened to the child. You know, there's not much information on it.
I looked at a picture of him, though, and he seems like a pretty ordinary dude. He almost looks like a Cambodian version of Elon Musk. You know, he really doesn't look like a very dangerous person, and there's a picture of him even in his old age before he died of what was a supposed heart attack. And he looks like a jovial, fun. He's smiling and laughing in this picture. Mm. He said on his deathbed, virtually, certainly in the last interview that anyone did with him, that he had no regrets. He said, everything I did for my country. Phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
incredible.
What a strange world you must live in your head when you think you can get away with social engineering on this scale. And really, that's what he will go down in history for, is trying the most audacious kind of social engineering that turned things backwards and tried to eliminate all difference between people. He tried to make people numbers, machines, robots.
Very classless.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is just one of the most evil things that could ever have been perpetrated against humanity. Do we know anything about the last years of his life, where he was? Because you said he was in the jungles, you know, up to kind of the 1980s. But where did he end up?
So he died just close to the Thailand border. So that's where he went deep into the jungle. And he spent a lot of time there in his youth. And that's where he really got the love. And he believed the way they lived. He said, that's the way this whole country must live. And so, yeah, he went back there, and I think he was very well protected. And he was a figurehead for the Khmer Rouge for, you know, right into the 90s, although he stepped down as their leader in 1985. He stayed in that area, and he kept guerrilla campaigns going on up until the 90s. And that's not long ago. So this movie, The Killing Fields, had already been put onto the circuit around the world, and he was still doing guerrilla campaigns in the northern parts of Cambodia. I think in the end, it fell apart. And they had some sort of house arrest, but they think it was just a front. He got away with it, and then he died.
Yeah, supposedly he was arrested by another senior Khmer Rouge figure, and they did sentence him to life imprisonment. But, I mean, he seems to have got off really easy, because he did die of this heart failure, as you say, in 1998. But and he's buried in this miserable little grave. I saw a picture of it on the internet. And it's got like a broken wooden fence around it. And you know the kind of corrugated iron that you see on the roofs of so many houses in South Africa? You see a lot of it in the squatter camps. It's got like a piece of bent iron over a little wooden structure. And then underneath is really just a heap of earth, which is surrounded by stones. And nothing smart about it. In front, there's a little altar with some incense sticks. And then it's got grave of Pol Pot. No one's defaced it. You've got to ask yourself how he got away so scot-free and how his grave has not been covered in concrete. Like, you know, no one worships Stalin anymore. No one worships Hitler anymore. These people have been universally acknowledged as evil. And yet this dude, he's lying there in peace in the country that he ruined.
And, you know, I think the Khmer Rouge still had a place in the United Nations. You know, I think as late as the turn of the century. So that boggles the mind. I just think that there was a lot of funny things going on with the Cold War, and the U.S. then started supporting the Khmer Rouge to take the Vietnamese out because there was a puppet government in Cambodia. So there was a whole lot of funny things going on, and maybe that's why he got away with it. I don't know. You know, it was very sad.
Like you've already pointed out, they kind of flew under the radar because there were so many bigger fish to fry in terms of international players. And Cambodia just wasn't important enough for people to have paid attention.
Yeah.
And it just shows you, not all people are equal. So it kind of, in some sick way, it proves that that inequality is the way, the state of man. Yeah. So history is not always fair. And the fact that a guy like this, you know, died of natural causes and under house arrest where he committed such atrocities. It's just unbelievable. It boggles the mind. And of course, that part of the world is never fully recovered. But Cambodia has a rich and ancient history. There's obviously those famous ruins of Angkor Wat there, which comes from a much more ancient civilization that actually was part of the flag. They had the main temple in Angkor Wat as the symbol in the middle of their communist Democratic People's Republic of Kampuchea. They had that symbol on their flag. Apparently, there are museums you can go to in Cambodia now where they have just walls with skulls, almost like the catacombs in Rome or in Paris, but many, many more people that have died and whose remains are now in these unbelievably huge mausolea.
It's a very lucrative country, and it's quite beautifully placed down into the South China Sea, and it's got some of the best freshwater fish in the world, even today. So if you want to go and catch big freshwater fish, you go to Cambodia. It's a fertile area for fishing and that.
But it's an interesting part of the world. I don't think, though, that it's completely out of the woods yet. There's still elements of the Khmer Rouge alive and well in that part of the world. There's still lots of fights between the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, and many others.
It's taken them literally 30 years or even more to recover, if they have recovered from it.
What a guy. Not one of our favorites, but he fits into the same category as some of those maniacs that we've covered before, like Vlad the Impaler, Stalin,
yes,
many of the others.
But you know, Vlad doesn't look so bad anymore.
So there he is, Pol Pot, Cambodia's Killing Fields, and a new episode of Blind History. We're into season 4. There are many more exciting people to cover, and I guarantee you one of them is going to be your favorite, and then one of them is going to be the kind of person that you hope you never hear about again. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Here's a quote from Prince Norodom Sihanouk, the former ruler before Pol Pot took over. He said, "Pol Pot does not believe in God, but he thinks that heaven, destiny, wants him to guide Cambodia the way he thinks it is best for Cambodia. Pol Pot is mad, like Hitler."
Couldn't have said it better.
Yeah, that's exactly right. CliffCentral.com.